welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. Going right to the news, our top war story tonight. Printed in the Evening Ledger, Allies checked by Turks in Gallipoli fight. Printed out of Philadelphia, August 25th, 1915.
Allies checked by Turks in Gallipoli fight. Constantinople reports attacks at Anafarta repulsed. Amsterdam, August 25th. An official statement by the Turkish government at Constantinople received here last night says, on August 22nd, the Allies attacked on the new front near Anafarta on the Gallipoli Peninsula, but were repulsed with heavy losses. On the Iraq front, our troops attacked a British detachment near Akika on the Euphrates, inflicting heavy losses.
Returning to the home front, we have the distinct pleasure of bringing you a unique story. Major Francis Wilfred Brunner was an officer with the Royal Engineers involved in the Gallipoli campaign in the summer of 1915. His wife, Margaret Amelia Brunner, kept a scrapbook during the early years of the war. We had the distinct pleasure of having with us at the station the very scrapbook of Margaret Brunner. We're going to read a few excerpts from it now. The first item we're going to share are some personal ads from September 1915. Personal ads during the war included the normal inquiries about lost possessions and notes from those seeking companionship, but there were also many family members seeking information about their loved ones who were fighting in the war.
Lost at Hooge on July 30, the diary of Lieutenant Gilbert Talbot, Rifle Brigade, who fell in action that day. The finder is asked to forward it to Mrs. Talbot, Farnham Castle, Surrey. Lost, August 26, in James Street, Oxford Street, or 73 Omnibus. Diamond pendant in case. Reward if returned. Number 23, Queensgate Terrace, Southwest. Young lady would gladly correspond with lonely colonial or English officer. Box Y324, The Times. Would kind sympathizer brighten existence of lonely soldier in hospital by writing him? Box Y355, The Times. Lady would be grateful for cheerful correspondence with officer at the front. No pessimists. Box Y347, The Times. Lady Dorothy Fielding, Newnham, Lutterworth, will gratefully receive and acknowledge subscriptions to the Hector Monroe Motor Ambulance Corps, which has been running a field ambulance convoy in Flanders since September last. Funds urgently needed to carry on work. Mrs. Wilfred Brunner, Hollymount, Lancashire, will be grateful if anyone can give her news of her husband, Major F.W. Brunner, Royal Engineers, reported missing and known to have been last seen with the East Yorkshire Regiment on August 9th, in action in the Dardanelles. Mrs. Willie, at number 10 Launceston Place, Kensington, would be most grateful if any officers or men returning from Germany give her any information about Captain Hugh T.W. Willie, 4th Royal Irish Dragoon Guards, reported missing May 24th and believed to be a prisoner of war. Can any exchanged prisoner give Major H. Harmon Young any information concerning his son, 2nd Lieutenant H.H. Young, 3rd Royal Fusiliers, who was reported wounded on May 24th and has been missing ever since? Please reply to Major H. Harmon Young, Balgowan, Dorking. Trained hospital nurse wishes to give her services to military hospital, Egypt, Malta, or London preferred. Address A, number 13, Collingham Place, Southwest. Doctor, engaged in special practice in Harley Street, would assist in return for use of motor car and chauffeur. Box Y353, The Times.
Mrs. Brunner's scrapbook contains many lists of the missing, wounded, and killed, clipped from the newspapers through the early years of the war. None of the entries in the scrapbook are nearly as chilling as the following. From the Northwick Guardian, September 1915, Major Brunner, Royal Engineer, missing.
Major Brunner, R.E., missing. Captain Godfrey Brunner reported wounded. The casualty list of officers in the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, published on Tuesday, contained the names of Major F.W. Brunner, R.E., amongst the missing. Major Brunner is the son of Mr. Henry Brunner of Hyton, Liverpool, a director of Brunner, Mond & Company, a nephew of Sir John Brunner, and a cousin to the member of the Northwich Division. He joined the army some years ago as an officer of the Royal Engineers. He went out to the Dardanelles about the end of June. He is the younger brother of Mr. H.B. Brunner, who is an official at Brunner Mons Works and resides in the Hollies, Hartford. Another son of Mr. Henry Brunner, Captain Godfrey Brunner, who is well known in Northwich and is a very popular officer of the 5th Cheshire Territorials, is reported to have been wounded in the Dardanelles. Inquiries show that the telegram has been received stating that Captain Brunner has been wounded and is returning to England on a hospital ship.
Margaret's scrapbook ends in September 1915, presumably after receiving word of her husband's likely death. A formal obituary for Major Brunner wasn't published until a year later, in an issue of The Chemist and Druggist from September 16th, 1916.
Died on service. Brunner, Major Francis Wilfred Brunner, Royal Engineers, reported missing in Gallipoli on August 9th, 1915, and known to have been dangerously wounded, is now officially presumed killed in action on that date. Major Brunner was the second son of Mr. Henry Brunner, of Highton, who died in June last, and was educated at Berkhamsted and Woolwich. He obtained his commission in the Royal Engineers in July 1890, and, after the usual course at Chatham, he was posted to a field company. He went to India in 1895 to join the Bengal Sappers and Miners, and saw service with them in China in 1900. He returned to England in 1902, and for 3.5 years commanded a depot company, then passed into the Staff College in 1906. Subsequently, he went to the War Office and became Chief Instructor in Military Engineering at the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. This appointment he held until September 1914, when he took command of one of the new field companies, and went to Gallipoli on July 1st, 1915.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we return, some fiction and an update on the women on the war's home front.
Dreer's Bulbs for Autumn Planting. Easter 1916 comes on April 23rd, just the time when hyacinths, tulips, and narcissus or daffodils are in full bloom. Bulbs must be planted this fall, and now is the time to make your selection from our autumn catalog. We offer the finest bulbs of hyacinths, tulips, narcissus, crocus, iris, snowdrops, scillas, etc. Plan now to make your garden gay for next Easter and write for a copy of our autumn catalog. Henry A. Dreer, 714-716 Chestnut Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The best gift calendar for the year 1916, Victorious German Commanders. Issues and Events has just published this calendar, and orders for it are coming in so fast that only by increasing our facilities have we been able to keep pace with the demand. Each month shows one of Germany's great leaders, von Hindenburg, Mackensen, von Bülow, von Kluck, von Tirpitz, and others. Each is a striking portrait by a noted artist printed on fine, durable paper and bound with silk. The portraits alone would sell for 25 cents each, but by special arrangement, Issues and Events has been able to offer the calendar with the 12 portraits for $1. Orders will be filled in the order they are received. The supply is limited, hence only those who act promptly will be able to take advantage of our extraordinary offer. Order today, Issues and Events, number 21 Park Row, New York.
Welcome back to Mail Call. Up next, we have a piece of fiction titled The Boys Aviators with the Air Raiders, A Story of the Great World War. We're going to read you Chapter 14, published in 1915.
Chapter 14, The Peril in the Sky. Day after day, the wounded from the front were being received in Dunkirk, Calais, and other places along the coast. They were usually taken further on as soon as their immediate wants could be attended to. In many cases, the stricken soldiers would be carried by train to the large Red Cross hospitals in and around Paris. Then, besides this, on many a night, a steamer would start from Dunkirk around the Channel bearing hundreds of British back to their own shores, where they could receive the best of care among their people. These voyages were made when possible in the gloom of night and at full speed in order to avoid the risk of having the vessel torpedoed by lurking German submarines ready to deliver crushing blows to her enemy's ships. Frank stood in the crowd and watched the transfer of the poor fellows to the temporary hospital. They were mostly British soldiers who had received their injuries while trying to hold the trenches against some fierce drive on the part of Bavarians or Prussians. As he saw one after another swathed figure borne on stretchers from the ambulance motors into the hospital, Frank felt a sense of pity for all these who were suffering on account of this terrible war, no matter on which side they chanced to be. He finally turned away, not caring to see any more such pitiful sights. He marveled at the brave front displayed by even the most dreadfully wounded men, who tried to greet the crowd and smiled through the mud that plastered their faces. Remembering what he and Billy had discovered in connection with the gathering of a new army back of the German trenches, Frank expected that in a few days there was bound to be a greater stream of wounded pouring into Dunkirk than ever before, because a desperate attack was doubtless contemplated. When he learned from Major Nixon that some of the Allies' aviators had brought in the news concerning that gathering host of gray-clad soldiers, Frank realized that he could speak of it without reservation, since it would not be giving information as to the enemy's contemplated plans. Remembering one more errand which needed his attention, Frank, after leaving the vicinity of the Red Cross Hospital, had immediately started to look after it. He was through with it and actually starting for the hangar when once again he became aware of the fact that a sudden confusion had broken out. People were shouting in an excited manner, as though a mad dog had broken loose and was coming down the main street of Dunkirk. There was no difficulty in learning what was the matter. That wild cry of alarm was becoming very familiar to the ears of the worried citizens of Dunkirk these stormy days. The Germans are coming! The Germans are coming! In French and in English, this shout was being carried along, constantly added to by scores of voices. People rushed pell-mell this way and that, many dodging down into cellars as though seeking safety from some terror that was likely to descend on the coast city like a cyclone. Those who were not yet running had their necks craned and their eyes turned upward toward the northeast. Frank stepped over to where he could see better, and then he also rubbered, as Billy would have called it. On numerous occasions, the German aviators had conducted an organized raid on Dunkirk, dropping dozens of terrible bombs in what seemed like an indiscriminate fashion. Possibly, these were in the main intended to damage the camps or accumulated stores of the British legions, but if so, the aim of the men in the Taubes was singularly bad, for the majority of the bombs had thus far either exploded in the open fields or shattered private houses. Many innocent persons, including women and children, had suffered from these explosives, and it was not singular then that whenever the cry was raised that the Germans were coming, meaning a raiding flock of aeroplanes, there would ensue a mad panic in the streets of the French city. "There are several moving things over there away up in the heavens," Frank told himself as he gazed in more or less excitement. "Even without a glass, I'm almost ready to say they can't be Taubes." He stood there watching and waiting until the soaring objects drew closer, when their true identity could be discovered. Frank, being an aviator himself, quickly detected certain things that the common observer might never have discovered, and which told him the half-dozen specks in the sky that February morning were birds and not aeroplanes. "Some gulls flying high," he murmured as he watched. "Yes, there they circle around," which aviators bent on bombarding the city and then running off in a hurry would never think of doing. He told those near him that there was nothing to fear, as the suspected Taubes were only harmless birds. The cheering word was passed along from mouth to mouth, and some of those who only a few minutes before were looking very peaked and white commenced to laugh, trying to make out that they knew all along the advancing specks were only birds. By degrees, even the shivering inmates of the cellars learned that it was a false alarm and ventured to appear again. "And I suppose this happens several times every day," Frank mused as he watched the arteries of traffic once more begin to flow naturally. "While little damage that amounts to anything has been done by the bombs, the coming of the Germans is looked forward to with dread. I suppose if a flyer happened to be brought down with a well-directed shot from a gun, it would give the people more pleasure than anything they could wish for." It struck him that possibly the other boys might have heard something of all this excitement and would be worried about him, so Frank stepped into a store he knew of and proceeded to get the hangar on the wire. There was some little difficulty at first, as though a good many people were trying to communicate with their homes for some purpose or other. Finally, a voice called in good English, "Hello, that you, Frank?" "Yes, that's who it is, Billy. I only called you up thinking you might have heard all the shouting and wonder what it was." "Oh, some of the guards here guessed it, and we've been watching the gulls through our field glass. But how about the other business, Frank? Is it all fixed?" "I'm coming back right away," Frank told him. "Soon after I join you, there will be something doing. I'll tell you the rest when I get there, but everything is going on okay. So long, Billy. Keep watching, for they're ready to try everything under the sun to gain their end. I've got a new story for you when I come." Frank, by this action, had not only accomplished his purpose of relieving the minds of his chums, but at the same time he had made sure that things were unchanged at the hangar. Determined not to take any risks that could be avoided, Frank waited until he saw a battery of field pieces moving along the road that led close by the gate of the hangar. Perhaps the guns had come over from England on the previous night, and being badly needed at the front, were starting forth. This was the opportunity he wanted. By keeping alongside the guns and caissons, he could defy any hidden danger. If there were spies waiting to waylay him in some rather lonely spot, just as they had Pudge on the preceding night, the presence of those young khaki-clad warriors seated on the gun carriages and ammunition carts would foil them. There was no trouble. Possibly Frank might not have been held up even though he chose to take the walk without any protection, but when in doubt, it was always his policy to play safe. When he again found himself in the hangar, the others were eager to hear what he had promised to tell them. "You've been having another scrape of some sort, like as not," ventured Billy, pretending to look morose, as though he begrudged his comrade that privilege, while he and Pudge were only sitting there killing time. Frank thereupon related how he had been drawn into rendering assistance when the said-to-be wife of an apparent citizen of Dunkirk, who spoke excellent English without a French accent, appeared to faint close to the door of her own home. The other boys were thrilled by what seemed like a narrow escape on the part of their comrade. "Ganders and gridirons, Frank," exploded Pudge after listening with distended eyes to the account given by the returned chum. "That was a narrow squeak for you, as sure as anything." "Yes," added Billy, "they had it all laid out to trap you. If you'd dared to step inside that open door, I reckon you'd have been tapped over the head, and when you came to again, it would be to find yourself in some old damp and moldy cellar. I give you credit for tumbling to their smart game, Frank." "Bayous and bullfrogs, they certainly do want to get hold of this bully machine of ours the worst kind, and that's a fact," spluttered Pudge. "But tell us about the Major and what he agreed to do," asked Billy. "It's all fixed just as we figured it," replied Frank. "I want this man here to understand what has been done, so come over to where you've got him." The prisoner had been watching them eagerly. He must have guessed that Frank had been gone to settle about his fate, and if ever a man looked nervous, he did as the three boys advanced toward him. "Listen to something I want you to hear," said Frank. "We know what you are, and that if you were given in charge as a spy, you'd likely be shot by tomorrow morning. But we are American boys, and not at all inclined to have the blood of a German honestly serving his fatherland on our hands. Do you understand what I am saying?" "Yes, go on," muttered the man, brightening up, though still anxious. "I've arranged it with the authorities that you will only be looked on as a petty thief. You will be held in close confinement for a few days until it is certain that any information you may have picked up while here in this building will be useless. Then they will take you out of the city and set you free with a warning never to be seen here again if you value your life." Now the man's face lighted up in a smile. "That is much better," he said, after drawing a long breath of relief. "We thought you were on the side of the Allies because you meant to turn it over to the French government." "You must remember," said Frank impressively, "that this machine has been over here, boxed but not assembled, for months before the war opened. My company had a contract with the French people, who insisted on representatives being sent across to demonstrate the new flyer. Otherwise, they threatened to seize it and make duplicates without our receiving any remuneration. The necessities of war. That is why we have come, and are even now trying to carry out the terms of that agreement. You can tell your people that only for this our company would not dream of making airplanes for one side or the other. They could not be shipped out of the United States, anyway." "I understand your position," said the man, "and while it explains many things, it does not change our design to prevent the enemy from profiting by your improved type of machine. If by any means it can be stolen or destroyed, we believe we are only doing our duty by the fatherland and risking our lives to attempt it. Well, here comes a patrol to take you to the city prison. And remember, you are to insist that you entered our hangar to steal, not to spy on us," Frank told him.
We now have an update on the fight for women's right to vote from the Ardmore Chronicle, November 1915.
Suffragists carry 33 Pennsylvania counties. 315,000 men on record at polls vote yes for suffrage. Complete returns from the counties in the state show that the proposed suffrage amendment to the Constitution was defeated by 53,000. The counting of votes all over the state was slow due to the many local fights which overshadowed interest in the state ticket and in the four amendments before the people. It is believed that more than 300,000 men favored the proposed suffrage amendment to the state constitution. Figures so far received show a total of 284,538 for and 337,560 against the amendment. Philadelphia cast 41,236 majority against suffrage. The total polled for suffrage in the city was 72,179 for and 113,415 against. Suffrage triumphed in six Philadelphia wards, the 22nd, 32nd, 34th, 41st, 42nd, and 46th, and lost the 40th ward by only one vote. Accepting their defeat, but hailing it as a magnificent victory, 2,500 suffragists held the most enthusiastic rally in Philadelphia's history Wednesday night at the Academy of Music. Dr. Anna Howard Shaw, the suffrage leader of the country, made a great speech. The meeting inaugurated a new campaign for suffrage victory. Women in all parts of Pennsylvania are celebrating the victory at the polls on Tuesday, which has proved to them and to the entire country that suffrage is a live issue in the state, and the campaign that they have waged has swept away prejudice, doubt, and ignorance, and recruited to their defense an army of about 315,000 men.
Up next from the publication Issues and Events, published November 20th, 1915, a brief history about, if not targeted at, the country of Great Britain.
The spreading of English culture. Of all conquering nations, Great Britain's history is the blackest. The crowning piece of British hypocrisy in the present war was the great holier-than-thou holding up of hands over the so-called violation of Belgian neutrality. From a nation which, for hundreds of years, has fattened off of the lifeblood of subjected races, such a protest was an unparalleled piece of national cant. Scarcely was the war well underway when Britain herself formally annexed Egypt, and our newspapers use the infamous move as an excuse for gloating over Germany, having nothing but praise for English action in the terminating the liberties of Egypt. Yet hardly more than a generation ago, England had no claims whatever in Egypt. Today, Egypt, once a mighty empire, is completely under the domination of a country which has not a shadow of a right to be there, and which completed its robbery of the liberties of a nation while protesting hypocritically against the violation of Belgian neutrality by another power which found itself under a desperate compulsion of passing through Belgium as the only possible means of saving itself from defeat. England, in the subjugation of Egypt, has not made, nor can she make, any plea for justification. It was simply another of the long and shameless series of outrages by which she has acquired her various colonies and dominions. Of all the nations that have ever conquered others, England's history as a conqueror is the blackest, and the atrocities she has been guilty of are more numerous and damnable than those which have ever been committed by any other nation. England as the mistress of the seas, England as the peaceful, sleek, contented, good-natured lion, is the picture most impressed today upon the minds of neutral countries. But England today is a good-natured lion, because practically everything which may be eaten has already been devoured, and because her subjected lands are pacified. Like the accusation against Rome that her soldiers made a wilderness and called it peace, so England starves and impoverishes her subject races and calls it pacification. England's policy towards Ireland. For centuries, England has pursued a policy of extermination against Ireland. It has been the aim to impoverish and ruin that country, and that aim has never been lost sight of. In the times of Cromwell, the oppression of Ireland was frightful beyond words. After almost extirpating the population, the English government confiscated the land, simply robbed the private owners of it, and offered it for sale. Various freebooters received great tracts of lands for services. Thus, the terrible burden of landlordism was fastened on Ireland, and ever since that time, an enormous drainage of money to England has continued, enriching the English rich and impoverishing the Irish. Cursed thus with absent landlordism, Ireland has continually been insulted for her poverty by the very beneficiaries of the system which produced that poverty. Insults, however, have been the smallest part of Ireland's score against England. In the song, The Wearing of the Green, the centuries-old resentment for the hanging of her patriots is still vitally expressed. It is perhaps the most profound protest that has ever had musical expression of the feelings of the oppressed and conquered.
Another piece from the publication Issues and Events. From December 1915, we have a piece looking forward to the end of the Great War. What of America after the World War?
What of America after the World War? We need to take a national inventory of our abilities and liabilities. We must puncture the bubble of conceit at which we have been worshiping half a century, by Dana Burnett. Will there be an American Renaissance at the end of the present war? If so, what will its nature be? Artistic, commercial, political, or spiritual? These questions are beginning to germinate in the national mind. Already, hosts of thoughtful Americans have turned their eyes toward that vague mirage, now scarcely distinguishable in the smoke clouds to the east, the mirage of European peace. What will happen to America when the tempest has subsided? More significantly, what will happen in America? The idea that we are not bound up in Europe's fortunes, that we are not concerned with her destinies, is rapidly being discarded as an obvious perversion of fact. Nominally and apparently, we stand aloof. In reality, we are directly affected by both the strife and the peace of our fellow nations. In this modern day, when science has put forth 1,000 tentacles between continents and established a community of interest among the varied races of the earth, it is no longer possible for a single country to pretend indifference to the fates of other countries. If there is any one thing which this war has proved in particular, it is that the world's inhabitants are bound by one fate, one destiny. In short, we are all in the same boat. Many persons are inclined to believe that we will be left in a sort of hostile solitude at the end of the war, that we will need to paddle our own canoe or be drowned in deep waters. This is not the fact as others see it. Our struggle, these others think, will be to maintain our place within the scheme rather than to separate from it. What does that mean? It means, in the first place, that we must take an inventory of our American stock, make an honest valuation of our abilities and liabilities. It means that we must puncture the bubble of the great American conceit, that brazen image at whose curling toes we have worshipped for half a century and more. In this, we will be assisted, are already being assisted, in fact, by expressions of opinion from those nations now engaged in defending civilization against a peculiarly efficient form of supermania. Europe, aflame with her sacrifices, hot from her fearful battlefields, looks toward us with her suffering soul in her eyes and cries out at our indifference. She probably misjudges us to a large extent, but at all events, we are conscious of that look in her eyes, and we have begun, at last, to search our restless American spirits to find out what makes them tick. Probably there was never a nation under the sun more certain of its ability to lick creation than the United States of America. The vociferous reiteration of this statement has been very nearly the sum of our patriotism for more than a generation. But is it patriotism to create a false security by shouting childish absurdities abroad? In some respects, we are the strongest people in the world. In other respects, we are the weakest. We are accepted as a great democracy, but our government does not voice the true sentiments of the people. We are a mass of self-contradictions, of vast potentialities and narrow attainments, of silly bluff and real stuff. We have conquered a continent in 100 years, and that is so remarkable a feat that it has rather dazzled us. If America should perish tomorrow from the face of the globe, that feat would stand as one of the marvels of history. But America is not going to perish tomorrow. She is going to live on, either as a great power or as the satellite of some other great power. It is to defend her from this latter fate that we must take stock, not only of our merchandise, but of our souls as well. The world is indeed a unit, but its component nations shift and change in their relations to one another, and of all the nations of the earth, it is our pride to say that America holds out to men the highest hope, the largest opportunities, the widest freedom. Undoubtedly, there will be an American Renaissance at the end of the war. We will learn to know ourselves and be born again, and the nature of the Renaissance will be artistic, commercial, political, and spiritual.
Our final piece comes to you from the Ardmore Chronicle, a look at the local women near the paper and how they are assisting the war effort by working hard at home.
Mainline Women Work for War Relief. Emergency Aid Committee makes over 2,500 garments in month. One of the best organized branches of the Emergency Aid Committee of Philadelphia is the Mainline Branch, whose 130 members have turned out more than 2,500 garments and surgical supplies in the last month. This organization turns the casino of the Marion Cricket Club at Haverford into a big exchange each Tuesday, where society women gather and plan how to make their efforts to aid the suffering soldiers in European armies more effective. One interesting phase of the work of the big committee, of which Mrs. Charlton Yarnall is chairman, is the fact that a way has been found to aid needy families in mainline communities by giving the women sewing to do on articles destined for European war hospitals and relief communities. A number of the fashionable women who have allied themselves with the branch have given money instead of personal labor, and through subcommittee, which investigates needy cases, women have been found glad of the opportunity to earn wages doing this work. Naturally, most of the work, however, is done by the women of the branch themselves at their homes. The branch found that it could have garments cut better by a firm of cutters in Philadelphia, that it would save time and money. According to Mrs. Herman Lincoln Clark, a member of the executive committee of eight of the branch, they took their cutting business to the firm of Haney, Kuttner, and Robb in Philadelphia. The work was done promptly and sent to the branch. When the executive committee asked for the bill, they were told there was no bill. "We found this was to go to the sufferers in Europe," they said, "and we found that our cutters wanted to help out, so they completed your order during portions of their lunch hour." Several sewing machine concerns have donated machines to the branch and have sent demonstrators to explain to the members how they are run. The articles turned out by the branch include such things as surgical sponges, surgical shirts, pajamas, slings, packings, bandages, and garments. They have been sent to the French Relief, the British American Relief, the American Ambulance Service, the Serbian Relief Committee, and the Surgical Supplies Committee. To attract public interest, the branch plans a series of meetings during the next month, two of which will be open to all, and at which speakers who have been in Europe and have seen some interesting things, even reaching the front, will deliver addresses. Mr. Duryea, who was at Dinard, France, when the war began, is scheduled to be the first speaker on January 4th.
That's it for this episode of Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and bulletins from the Great War. This episode featured the voice talents of Alexander Williams, David Uspel, Damian Katz, Laura Bang, Laura Matthews, and Sarah Wingo. Mail Call is produced and edited by Ramon McBride, with executive producer Laura Bang, additional editing and narration by myself, Chris Halberg. Historical documents from this episode were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library at Villanova University, the Internet Archive, the Library of Congress, and Project Gutenberg. The theme music is Till We Meet Again, as performed by the Nicholas Orlando Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War Centennial Exposition. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org.